Greetings and salutations, everyone. Welcome, everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy Aces, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob, KT2NVB, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages, and we also offer original articles and reviews on any topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. We also have an EchoLink node available for use. Just point your EchoLink application to the node kc2rc-r. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams do join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name and your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob KD2NVB will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the technical net or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob. Are you out there, Bob? This is AC2GS Roy here. With the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. Bob, do you receive me?
My mic's not connecting well. You got it this time?
I got most of it. Yeah, it's kind of a very iffy connection. Okay, that time it was a complete dead carrier. There was absolutely no audio modulation going on there.
Do you hear me now? Jesse, do you hear me now, Roy?
I hear you now. I hear you now.
Okay, yeah. Oh, well, wishing everybody a good net. Yeah, I tried an experiment. I put some masking tape on the my plug to see if it would make a better connection, and it did the opposite. I just removed the tape. We're back to the way I knew usually am. Wishing everybody good net. Back to net, Roy.
Okay, very good. Yeah, it probably needs a little bit positive force into the jack. Just keeping it in position with the tape probably doesn't supply the slight additional force it needs to make contact. Well, hopefully this will work for the rest of this technical net. One of these days you're going to surprise me and get a new microphone connection or even a new microphone. Anyway, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am net control for the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 p.m. To hopefully help people with their questions or explain topics of interest related to amateur radio or anything related to science and or technology if the questions go in that direction. So with all that in mind, If you have any questions out there and you would like to get at least have me attempt to answer it, hit that push to talk, give me your first name and your call sign. Well, it looks like it's going to be one of those slow nights. It's the eve of the last day of Passover, so one more day of matzah for me, and then I throw that stuff away for another year. Anyway, this is Roy, AC2GS, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. Anyone out there has any technical questions or topics for discussion, please feel free, hit that push to talk, and tell me your first name and your call sign, and we'll put you on the list for tonight.
AC2GS, this is Berlot, KD2MYF.
I see you on the Echo Link. I hope all is well. Do you have a question for tonight?
I do have a question for tonight. I am always struggling when people talk about, you know, digital. Sometimes I understand, sometimes I don't. Do you have a specific radio that you can use for digital only? Because that's where I'm struggling sometimes.
Okay. Digital, it can be a very complicated and multifaceted concept because there's a lot of things that a lot of people call digital, and they fit under a very wide umbrella, but in some ways they're really talking about completely different things. Ultimately, a lot of CW Morse code enthusiasts will tell you, rightly so, that Morse code was the first digital transmission mode. Because it was just on or off, and that's sort of what digital is, binary, ones and zeros. Most people don't think of CW and Morse code as ones and zeros. They think of dits and dahs and pauses, but for all intents and purposes, that's a digital mode. Now, there are all kinds of other digital modes. If you go to UHF, VHF, a lot of times the person is really referring to a digital voice mode in which your voice is digitized, and then it is run through an algorithmic encoder, decoder for word fragments called phonemes, and then those little binary output is then modulated and transmitted, received by someone else, either in a repeater or into the internet and down into a hotspot and back up again. Then the bit stream is decoded back into phonemes, and the phonemes are put together as an audio file and plays the other guy's message to you in an understandable way. So that's on one end of the spectrum. Those are voice digital. There's data digital also, which includes the famous FT8, in which there's no real voice. It's just the data is compressed into data streams. For different purposes, it could be slow scan TV, it could be FT8, it could be all kinds of radio teletype. All these things can also be considered digital radio. You don't need to per se have a digital radio to do HF digital stuff. You can use the audio stream of your radio and a computer interface of some kind, even a Raspberry Pi sometimes, to encode and decode those messages. But if you're going to do something like D-Star or Fusion or DMR, it's probably best to have a radio designed for that with the conversion built in. You can do the conversion offline. I have something called a Blue DV, which runs on my computer and plugs into the internet and allows me to operate like a hotspot, but without the necessity for a handy talkie or a hotspot. It's just a microphone in my computer going into the internet, going into Brandmeister or what have you, and then coming out other people's handy talkies and hotspots.
Yes, this is me again, KD2MYF. If I understand correctly, do I need or would I not need internet service for for me to do digital? Do I need internet service, or is not very important for me to have internet service so I can still have digital without internet service? That's my question.
Okay, I guess it sort of depends on which type of digital service you're talking about. If you're talking about the HF digital service, you do not need to have the internet. Everything is handled through your radio. It has to go through a computer, but the computer doesn't have to be hooked up to the internet. If you're talking about direct conversations of DMR radios and D-Star radios and Fusion radios to the repeaters, you also don't need an internet connection. If you had a Fusion radio, you could make contact with our repeater, and that would be digital radio. So for those purposes, you don't need an internet. The only reason you would need an internet is if you were not going to be operating completely in the RF range, if RF was just a small portion of the transmission path, and as it is in the case of hotspots, you talk on a handy talkie, which is RF, but the RF is just going to the next room over where your hotspot is receiving it and fiddling with the bits and then sending it through your internet service provider. So when you're using a hotspot, you definitely need to have an internet connection. But if you're going to go through repeaters, or if you're going to go from person to person through RF, you don't need the internet.
Thank you. I think I used Fusion before. Now I understand better. Thank you. Back to you.
You're welcome, Berlot. Digital radio is kind of the most modern form. It uses a lot of them will use some phase shift modulation that's somewhat more esoteric than the old time amplitude and frequency modulation, and even the simple phase modulation, which is closely related to FM modulation. So it's the newest and shiniest. Some people love it. Some people hate it. I consider it another blade in my Swiss Army knife, and I could use as many blades as I can get. So I have hotspots, and as I mentioned, I have Blue DV, and I listen into, there's at least one net I listen to every Friday night, the Papa Network on the West Coast. Has connections to a bunch of different internet-based gateways, because you're not going to pick up any FM-modulated UHF or VH signal from the West Coast under most circumstances. So I use it every Friday night so I can listen to the antenna technical net there on the West Coast.
Well, thank you. I leave it now if someone else is out there, they can ask questions, and then after that I can come back. 82 MIF.
Okay, very good, Berlot. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month, starting at 9 p.m. and going for as long as it needs to go. Depends on if what the questions are, how long the questions take to answer, and the interest that continues. We're kind of open-ended. Sometimes we end early, sometimes we end late. So if you're out there and you have a question, you'd like to have someone try to answer it, or you have a topic for discussion that you just want to hear about a little bit more, then hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign. Well, once again, these technical nets very often do start up a little bit on the slow side. I don't know if people forget that, it starts at 9 o'clock and they say to themselves at 9:15 or 9:20 or 9:30, oh yeah, it's that time of the month again. Sometimes I think up little monologues at the very beginning so that we don't start smack at 9 o'clock at night, but it's already 9:17, so you'd think that some people who are latecomers would have arrived and sat down and gotten comfortable. So if anyone's out there who has any questions or comments or topics of interest, then please hit that push-to-talk button and give me your first name and call sign. Well, it looks like it's going to be a very, 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 very quiet night tonight. So, Berlot, if you do have a second question or topic available and you want to ask me, this probably is a good time.
Yes, I have a second question. My second question is basically about antenna. I figured that when I have my radio and I am close to the sea, I have better connection than when I am far from the sea. I don't know if it's something random or if there is a connection between being closer to the sea, you know, with a radio, you know, or something. So can you explain if there is any connection? Because I am still trying to understand, you know, what is going on with, you know, HT and, you know, closer to the sea and, so, you know, things like that. If there is anything that you know of, I will be very happy to listen to that part.
Okay, very good, Berlot. Yeah, it's a very common finding. Matter of fact, we used to have people on the 10-meter net who would travel around Sunday mornings, and they'd park their car near a body of water, and usually in New Jersey, and they came across rather strong to Brooklyn. It's a combination of factors. One is that you're certainly not going to get blocked by any buildings if you're near flat bodies of water. There's no large apartment complexes that are put up in water areas. So you have the lack of buildings getting in the way, and also the salt water tends to improve the ground wave propagation. Apparently, electromagnetic waves that we use, they travel in kind of two considerably different modes. Locally, we call it ground wave propagation. Those are electromagnetic waves that kind of skirt the ground, the surface, you know, maybe a couple of yards, you know, 10, 20 yards above the surface, but little else. And then there is the sky wave propagation, which is where we get a lot of our distance communications. That's why we like aim our antennae at the horizon, so it kind of skips on the ionosphere, gets refracted back down, and sometimes it'll bounce back up and refract another time, and it'll do two bounces up and down. But locally, when we're dealing with people in Brooklyn and Queens and New Jersey and Staten Island, it's almost all ground wave propagation. So the less buildings in our way, and the better the conduction area for near ground propagation of electromagnetic waves, the better. So you've noticed something that a lot of other hams have noticed and taken advantage of.
My follow-up question is, what difference does that make if I am, you know, on top of a building in Brooklyn compared to when I am on top of a building in Manhattan? Is that based on where the repeater are located, or there is something different that I need to know of?
Okay. Well, if you're talking about UHF and VHF, because that's where most repeater action is involved, UHF and VHF do not really do well with skywave propagation. They work best as point-to-point transmission. So if you can raise your elevation to the point where you can see the other antenna, then you're going to have a nice strong signal. If you go lower in the in elevation and get blocked more and more by buildings, the signal will degrade more and more. So line of sight is a very important thing. And also distance. So if you have a line of sight in both Manhattan and Brooklyn for something, say, in Westchester or in Long Island, you'll probably get a slightly stronger signal, all things being equal, in Manhattan, because most areas of Manhattan are a little bit closer. There's a shorter length connecting a piece of wire or a piece of string between the two, as opposed to I live on the very edge near Coney Island. And so a lot of signals have to travel longer distance to get to my to my location, my QTH.
Okay, thank you. I guess that's it for me for tonight. Thank you. Back to you, KB2MYF.
Thank you very much, Berlette. Thanks for participating. That's the life and blood of Tactical Nets. Call out again. I continue to be AC2GS. My name continues to be Roy, and this continues to be the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We get together here every second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. to hopefully help out people with their technical questions and topics for discussion. So if there's someone out there who has a question, especially about amateur radio, but any kind of science and technology, curious about things, why the sky is blue, you know, what have you, then please hit that push-to-talk button and tell me your first name and your call sign.
Good evening, Roy. This is KG2VEA. Max, I have some questions about antennas.
Sure, Max. Please, give me some questions about antennas. Did you hear me, Max? I'd love to hear your questions regarding antennas.
Yeah, sorry. Clearly I wasn't transmitting. Can you hear me now, I hope?
You seem to be having some technical problems as well as Bob. I hear little bits of your audio and then it stops. So maybe you have a loose microphone connection as well. It's not catching.
This is KG2VEA. I wonder if I'm hitting the repeater, so I'm going to try to get the stream and see if it's worth the breakdown.
KG2NVP, I hear Max perfectly fine. I heard I think everything he said. Back to you, Roy.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know. I'm just going by this... by my radio. It's not even the computer or anything, because I'm able to kind of tell when there's a signal on the radio. It turns green, and it kind of goes in and out. So I don't know. Maybe I'm not picking up weak signals or something. I don't understand why. It's, you know, the repeater is the repeater. So as long as you get into the repeater, then the repeater should be should be giving me the same type of a signal than when you talk, unless Max is on the input, on the output and not the input.
I wonder, because I hear him very loud and clear, actually louder, maybe twice as loud as I hear you. So I don't know where he's located, but if he's close to me and not to you and he's doing that, I guess that's a possibility. I guess you'd have to ask him.
Yeah, that's not the way how it works. You should be hearing him not by himself, but through the repeater, and the repeater has the same power and distance no matter who contacts. The only difference is that if it's a weak signal, you have a lot more noise and there's not full quieting. So the only reason that one person would sound significantly different than another is if, rather than being on the input to the repeater, they were on the output frequency and they weren't going through the repeater, they were just going simplex.
What I meant, that if by some chance he was doing that and I was sitting here, you know, close to him or something. Back to you.
Okay, so we have a bit of a mystery here. I would suggest, Max, just kind of check on your frequency. Make sure that you're transmitting on 146.130 and not 146.730. And because occasionally, you know, things get a little bit mixed up, and that's been known to happen.
How about now? Any better?
Yes, I heard all of your transmission that time.
I heard a loud and clear again
into the stream, and I'm hearing myself on the repeater pretty well.
Yeah, you doubled a little bit with Bob, but like I said, the last few transmissions I heard fine.
Perfect. When we're ready, I can give you my antenna question.
Well, I'm ready if you're ready.
Alrighty then. So, I've told you that I built two antennas. One is a dipole, which, you know, I kind of coupled myself, so I'm not going to talk about that one because that, I think that one requires understanding a little bit if I use the right parts or not. But what I want to start with is the ARRL and the FED half wave antenna kit that they sell. it's a, I'm looking at the description here. It is a 10, 15, 20, 40 meter antenna with an impedance of about 2,500 ohms, and it has and we construct a 49 to 1 impedance matching network. So it's a 49 to 1 balun, I guess, or is it, yeah, balun, I guess. Well, actually, do not know. Anyway, so that's what I built, and that's what I'm trying to hang. So I'm assuming because I followed the instructions, it should be working. So more a question around getting it out of my apartment window. So I've just basically took it out of the window and hung it next to my building, which has windows and you know, concrete walls and so on. How far out of the building should I try to hang this wire out for it not for it to actually work?
Okay. Let's redefine a few things. What you have is called a half-wave and fed antenna. It's got to be the half wavelength of 40 meters, so it's approximately 20 meters in length, or about 65 feet. It has a 7-to-1 unun transformer that's, you know, 7 squared is 49, so that gives you the 49-to-1 impedance transformation. When you take a half-wave center fed, it has an impedance at the center feed of about 73 ohms, and as you slide it towards the edge, the impedance gets higher and higher and higher, and when you get it to very, very close to the edge, it goes up to anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 ohms, and so you need the 49-to-1 on to bring it back close to 50 or someplace where your antenna tuner can get it to 50. The higher you put it, the better it works. The farther away from large buildings, the better it works. That's not easily done usually, so you try as best you can. Some people mount it high on the part where it's connected to your building and the other end to a sloping other point, usually a tree or something. And you kind of hope for the best. Some people who don't have a straight line path from one to the other will put a little hook or a little crimp in it or something. It doesn't improve things, but it might not harm them too much. The NFED half waves, some people love them, some people hate them. It depends on the environment that you put it into also. The higher you put it, the less things around it, the less conductors nearby it, usually the better it works.
Okay, so I am on the sixth floor, so in terms of higher is good. But then the further away I can get it from the building is probably better as well. Just kind of wondering if I... What you were saying, if I have, let's say, if it starts at my window, travels horizontally for, let's say, a foot, and then drops down for a number of feet. By the way, I did cut a wire for 16 feet, for 10 meter half wave, so I didn't have to drop a full 40, you know, equivalent of wire because I didn't want to freak out my neighbors. But anyway, so about 16 feet. So if I go a foot out and then 15 feet vertically down, is that good, or should it be horizontal? Like, what's the optimal here?
Well, again, it depends upon what you can get away with. Probably, if you got the 6 floors of height, it probably would be best to make it as horizontal as you can. If you have it lying vertical, really relatively close to your building, that's going to block a lot of the radiation you know, one half of the radiation on that side. So horizontal would be what I would suggest. Now, I'm a little confused. You say you have an end-fed half wave for 40 up, but it's 16 feet long.
Yes, so I was kind of trying to follow the instructions. Basically, and maybe this is exactly where I went wrong. So the thought was, instead of dropping a, because I'm not trying to use it on 40 meters, I'm just trying to get on 10 meters. So what I did is I got another piece of wire for 16 feet, which should be roughly 16 feet. So it should be about, you know, half of a 10 meter to connect to that, to that box that does the 49:1. Or is that 49:1 designed for a wire that is for a halfway for 40?
All these numbers are dependent upon what frequency you're using. So when I said a half wave end fed, if you want to use it for 10 meters, then yeah, it should be approximately 5 meters long, which is about 16 feet. So you're doing exactly what you should. In the same way, a properly resonant center fed dipole, as I said, for 10 meters, properly made, has an impedance at the feed point of 73 ohms. A 80-meter center-fed proper dipole has the same 73 ohms. So it's not just the length. It's the length in relation to the wavelength of the frequency that you're planning to both transmit and receive. So you shouldn't have a problem with 16 feet as long as you're trying to get 10 meters. It's not going to be terribly effective for 40 or even 20, but hopefully it might be very effective for 10 meters. So again, I would probably try and keep it horizontal as opposed to relatively close to a building. Buildings are full of metal objects that are going to block RF emissions on one side of your radiation pattern. So you're kind of having your possible signal in half already. So if you can do it horizontally, or at least partially horizontally, inverted L's have been very successful. So, you know, as far as you could make it horizontal, I would try. And if there's some point where it just has to hang down, then so be it. It hangs down.
Interesting. So I think what you're telling me is just not horizontally versus vertically, but because I could run it horizontally right next to the building, but I don't think that's what you're saying. I think you're saying try to get it horizontal, but it's also perpendicular to the building, going kind of away from the building towards open air, right?
Well, if you could get it a little distance away from the house, probably that would be extra beneficial. But, you know, theoretically speaking, the radiation pattern is vaguely sort of like a donut. So some of it's going down and reflecting back up, and some of it's going up, and a lot of it's going off to the sides. So it's going every which way. So, you know, it's not quite that bad, as opposed to if you have it vertically oriented and very close to the wall of your apartment, in which then there's a real little room for it to go anywhere on one side. So generally speaking, in your case where the building is very close, better to have a close horizontal than a close vertical, and better to have a little extra distance where it begins, then right against your house. Although a lot of people do that with NFEDs and they don't have a problem. The only thing is you got to be very cautious and have RF chokes, because NFED half waves are infamous for common mode transmission and getting back into your shack and doing all kinds of wacky things to electronic equipment in your shack.
Interesting. So the RF chokes, we're talking about basically on all the equipment in the home, or RF chokes on certain parts of the antenna or the feed line? Where are we talking about?
You should generally put it on the coax. You really have to put it, right point of the coax. If you're running the antenna, say 2, 3, 4 feet away from your building surface, and you have that 4 feet of coax, before it gets into your house, you definitely should put the RF choke. But you don't necessarily have to put it right at the point of the feed of the feed point for the antenna. The best approach is to kind of block the common mode getting into your house, as opposed to running around to each electronic device in your shack and putting a separate choke, although you might need to do that in the end. But the best approach is to block it before it gets into your house.
Interesting. So it's pretty much, for me, would probably be where my feed line connects into the box that's built, the 49-to-1 transformer. So there's, connect the feed line to that. So as soon as it would be good to put a choke right after that connection over there. Is one of those clamp-on ferrite things fine, or do I need to find a giant circular one?
I have used both. But you get more bang for your buck, in my humble opinion, if you use the toroid, because if you use clamp-ons, every additional clamp-on serially adds more impedance and adds, in a linear fashion, more blockage for the common mode current going into your shack. Whereas every loop that you loop around the toroid gives you a square function. So in other words, if you put a coax through, say, three clamps, then it's three times the impedance of a single clamp. If you, on the other hand, twist your coax three times around your toroid, it's three squared. It's nine times the impedance. So you get more bang for your buck. If you're going to choke it all the way at the feed point, if it has an extra attachment for a ground connection, you should have some kind of little length of wire as a counterpoise. Because even though theoretically end-fed half-waves don't need counterpoises, they tend to use counterpoises. Whatever they can find, they try to use.
Yeah, I actually do have a counterpoise connection, and I do have a counterpoise wire, which I tried to research with what length it is, and I think I got it for a quarter length of the wavelength that I'm trying to do. I think that's what I ended up doing. And I guess the question is, should I drop that out of the window also, or does it matter?
Quarter length is okay. You can get into all kinds of arguments on 75 meters about what counterpoise lengths are best, and you'll get a thousand and one different answers, and they'll all be absolutely sure that they're right. So quarter length is fine. I would definitely throw it outside. I wouldn't have the counterpoise inside the house. Again, that's another source for stray RF that you really shouldn't have in your house.
Makes sense, and I'm going to try some of these. Funny thing is that my best attempt so far, where I could kind of hear some crackle and pop, but hear some voices, was not with this antenna, but with a 10-meter ham stick, which I basically mount on a bracket that's meant for a car, and then just, sticking out pretty much about 30 degrees vertically, off the horizontal, straight away from the building, and I can barely hear, and people can barely hear me, but at least I got something. All the other antennas, nothing, just noise.
Oh, well, there's all kinds of different antenna designs, and the environment has an effect. Ham sticks aren't inherently awful. They are not terribly efficient, but they are more efficient at the shorter wavelengths than the longer wavelengths, because the ratio of how shortened the whip is significantly different. If you try and figure out the length of a whip to the resonant frequency of a 10 meter hamstick versus an 80 meter hamstick, they are orders of magnitude different. So an 80 meter hamstick would probably be a couple of percentage efficiency, which isn't good. But 10 meters, you know, because 10 meters doesn't require a long quarter wave element, so you're only making up for a lesser percentage of shortening it with the loading coil. So it's not quite as bad as the case for lower frequency, longer wavelength transmissions.
Interesting. I gotta try some of these things. The thing is, everything I have has not been tested, so I'm playing with a homebrew antenna, with a radio I haven't really had a lot of luck with, because I haven't really tested it in a clean and clear way. So who knows what's really the failing factor, or for all of the above. I gotta play in a little bit better environment. It could be just, you know, the radio could be defective too. I don't really know that. I'm going to try to play with the antenna some more and see what happens.
Well, good luck with it. You're quite right. Being that you don't really know or trust your equipment yet because you haven't seen it soar, you could have a sensitivity problem with the radio's receiver, and so it could have nothing to do with the antenna. If you do have I think we talked about nano VNA. If you do have one, you should sweep it when it's in position. Sweeping it when it's on your tabletop isn't going to tell you a great deal. So try and sweep it when it's as close to real life conditions. And you're looking for a notch. You're looking for a point where the impedance drops down to the lowest. And hopefully that's somewhere around 50 ohms. If not, hopefully you have an antenna tuner that can get it closer to 50 ohms. But the important thing also is, where is that valley? Is that valley on the band that you're interested in? Or is it 10 megahertz up or 10 megahertz down, in which there's something wrong with it somewhere?
That's the last thing I kind of learned, because when I did the nano VNA testing, I was definitely not in the position that it's usually operated, and I was having it on the table while I was sitting next to it, and I don't remember actually even testing the antenna that was me testing the dipole. Yeah, I got a lot of trying to do. I think probably going to try to take it outside some days now that it's warm and see if I can get better results outside. Probably going to take it to the field day, see if anything happens there, and we'll see if I can isolate what the issue element is.
I think you have a good idea there. I wish you luck. You don't know until you try these things out, and for some people that's more than half the fun. So there are a lot of people out there who swear by NFED half waves. So as long as you got them off the ground and you got it cut to the right length, and the 49:1 transforming unun is doing its job, and it's not burning up too much energy, just heating up the transformer, then it should work to one degree or another. So I wish you luck, and I hope you'll come back and tell me, good, bad, or indifferent, how it worked for you.
Yeah, we'll do, for sure. To be honest, for me, getting things working is actually, I'd say, 80% of the fun. A lot of my hobbies start like that. Is like, I just want to see if I can get to do things. Like, can I do it? And then perfecting is usually the drag that I'm trying to persevere on some of them. But this is definitely one of the ones that's like getting to be able to operate is a big challenge. So it's kind of interesting. Just don't have a lot of time to try it out. But thank you for all the advice on the antenna stuff. I'm gonna play around and see what it comes out of. Gonna let someone else jump in if anybody else has questions. This is KG2BEA.
Very good. Thanks for participating tonight. Once again, I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy, And this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So if there's people out there with any technical questions or topics for discussion or comments on something that we talked about earlier tonight, and we still, of course, have the TechNet puzzle. It doesn't require seeing it because there's no illustration. It's just words. But as I said earlier, there's a link to the puzzle page on the front page of our club website, www.kc2rc.com, or you can just type into your browser's URL, puzzle.kc2rc.com, and it'll take you to our puzzle page. So hopefully there are still some questions. So if there's anyone out there with any other questions for tonight, please hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, I guess there's no more questions, at least for now. Let me see if I could pull up the puzzle for April 12, 2023. A circuit contains only inductance and resistance. A voltage is applied. Then, after an interval of 5 time constants has elapsed, the current will have one of the 4 qualities that you have to choose one of the best answers. A is it decreases to 0. B is the current reaches 1/5 of its final value. C is completed 5 complete cycles. D attained a constant value. Would anyone like to try out this little puzzle for tonight?
UNVB, I'll try.
Good, Bob. Thank you very much. Please try. I'm sure you'll get it.
I'm wrong about voltage being applied, turning it on rather than turning it off. I think it would be attains a constant value at D.
Indeed. That's the way inductors work. If it was a capacitor, it would be the opposite. But inductors kind of react to sudden changes. So immediately when you started to have a voltage potential, you would induce an opposite voltage potential to buck that current. But after there was no change in the voltage potential over time, in the same way that capacitors attain a full charge after about 5 time constants, you know, the so-called RC, in seconds and such. So if you have, if you hook up a capacitor to a battery that, say, has 9 volts, as over time, if you chart the voltage potential in the capacitor, it will slowly build up closer and closer to the 9-volt source. And by the time that 5 time intervals go, it will have built up to 99.9% of that 9-volt choice. So in the case of inductors, it's sort of the opposite, that it bucks the current immediately, but after 5 time intervals, that stops being a case, and it attains a steady state constant. So you are quite right. The answer is D, attained a constant value.
K2NVB. Roy, I'm just trying to refresh my memory. Like, each time constant, isn't it a roughly, like, say, the first time constant, it goes to a roughly 2/3 of power. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. There's a whole bunch. If you just Google time constant and capacitors, an endless stream of images that show this very nice asymptotic curve. Asymptotic means that it approaches a certain value by smaller and smaller intervals over time. So it makes a much more significant change during the early portion of the charge cycle. And as time goes on, the charge increase gets smaller and smaller and smaller. It never goes to 0, but it goes to something very, very, very close to 0. So yeah, that's characteristic of time constants.
Right, right. I knew that. It's sort of like Zeno's paradox, but, you know, once you get, you know, close enough for jazz, you know, you're not going to notice the differences after 5 times, I guess. I, from my memory, I mean, I knew all these exact numbers for the exam when I took it. I think it was roughly 2/3, so there's roughly two-thirds, and the second time it's roughly two-thirds of the way from two-thirds to 100%, and then roughly two-thirds of the way, et cetera, et cetera. Isn't that something like that?
That's the way we all kind of learned it. The only thing is the two-thirds of the remaining interval is smaller and smaller and smaller because that's what's left. So the increase, although it's two-thirds of what's left to be, is in absolute terms is getting really tiny after five time intervals, and you know, the fraction of a single percent.
Yeah, like the first two would be, if it's two-thirds, then the next one would be eight-ninths, and the next one would be, you know, on and on. Yeah, and after five or eight, you know, it's obviously so close, who cares after that?
Yep, that's the way it works. I don't know what's going on. I think your mic connector is kind of hiccuping. After you release the push to talk, there's a series of kerchunks that go on. So I'm thinking that it's just a little vibrations hitting the jack.
Yeah. I'm holding it now, really hard down. I think it's working right now without doing that. You're exactly right. It's going in and out, so it's kerchunking the repeater. Sorry. I'm going to, like, do something about this. I was looking up, trying to find those sort of jury-rig clip things you can get. I forgot the name of it. What's the name of this clip? It's an 8-pin plug, right? And I'm just going to know. I want to know the nomenclature, so I can look the darn thing up.
I don't recall exactly what it's called. I don't know if it would really work for you. Remind me, is it a proper eight-pin RJ, or is it something weird like a six-pin? And all I can tell you is I invested. It's not that expensive to experiment. I invested in those, and I tried to use them, and they really didn't work for me personally. I didn't use it for microphones. I used it for an actual Ethernet hub, but it didn't seem to kind of grab anything. I may have misinterpreted the instructions. I don't know.
Yeah, it's the same thing you guys. So it's 7100. It's the mic, the plug for the microphone. I think it's 8 pins. I mean, I'm looking at it, they're tiny. I'm trying to count them. It looks like 8 to me, and 8 sounds right. I'll look at my manual, you know. I guess you're talking about those things that just kind of jury-rigged that Joe AC2AE once suggested, and I looked up way back when. You're talking about those things. They're kind of dodgy, right?
Yeah, unfortunately they are, at least in my experience. I was very hopeful because it would solve problems. In the end, I basically just had to cut it off and recrimp it.
Yeah, I have to learn to do that stuff, or else get lazy and just buy another $50 microphone. Or is that? I wonder if that fancier mic with those buttons on the mic. I don't know if it'd be much use to me. Back to you.
Well, I bought it because it seemed interesting at the time. This was very early in my hobby. And they became annoyances to me. I immediately made sure that they were switched out, because when I palmed the microphone, if I didn't know what I was doing, I would push the wrong button and it would do weird things. So I would keep it simple, personally.
I was thinking the same thought, that I'd be like inadvertently pushing these buttons and having all sorts of weird things happen.
Yeah, I mean, if you can train yourself to kind of handle the buttons and you really need that in your hands control, I don't need to do almost any of the things that those buttons allow you to do. I mean, right now, I don't need to change the frequency. What would I do with another frequency? You know, I would be net control operator for another repeater. It just All I need is a trigger. That's the only control that I need for my radios. If I want to change the frequency, I can just go to the head and use the controls like most people probably do.
Especially because I have the head so close to me anyway. I have it on my, I have this little computer desk thing that rises up and down, and there's just room for the head. And it's like less than 2 feet away from me, so I don't think I have any use for it either.
Yeah, I mean, when I was young, I figured, what the hell? What's money? But again, it's just, I don't know, I found it deeply inconvenient. I have the same situation. I have the FTM 400 head in the middle of my desk. I have the ICOM 7100 head on the left-hand side under one of my side monitors. They're within hand reach. I can grab them and turn them and twist them and do anything that I need to. So I don't need to have it in my hand at all times when I'm trying to just push to talk.
Gotcha. Right now, every time I talk to you, I'm pushing like hell down this thing, and then as soon as I stop, I pull the damn thing out so it doesn't kerchunk.
Okay, I do appreciate it. I hope to see the day where you either fix it or get another one.
I just get another one.
We had a gentleman over at the Limark Technical Net who had a somewhat similar problem with a microphone connector, and I think after about 8 months, he finally just bought a used one someplace, and his problem went away. But it took him eight months to do that for some strange reason.
Well, I've got him beat by quite a bit.
Yes, indeed, you do. So you don't have to extend it any longer, Bob. You're the winner.
Yep, I'm slow to respond because I'm having to re-plug in the mic. But some of those good chunks were happening after I pulled it out, too. So, not sure what's going on. I should go. Unless somebody comes in, I'm getting up at 5:30 tomorrow for the first bird walk of the season. Back to you.
Okay. I understand entirely. I think we're going to close it down soon anyway. I got the vibes that there weren't really any questions in the channel. But I'll ask before I call it a night. I am AC2GS with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net, and if anyone has any technical questions they would like to ask tonight as opposed to on the 26th of April when I'll be back here at 9 p.m. to do this all over again. But if you'd like to get the answers tonight, then please hit that push to talk and tell me your first name and your call sign. What can I do you for, sir?
I was just monitoring my radio, and I heard you. I heard a bunch of beeps, so that did help get a new customer on there. And I assume this is a technical net.
Yes, this is the Kings County Radio Club's technical net. We've been doing this for about, I think, 6 or 7 years, maybe. The second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m., we get together and we do this. Since I'm a glutton for punishment, every Sunday night at 8 o'clock on the Limark repeater, W2VL, I run a technical net there as well.
Roger that. I'll have to monitor this channel a little bit more often. I don't want to keep you here in case some other people got some questions. I heard some of your responses. It's very interesting. I'm surprised I didn't get you, Little Ferry. I'm assuming you're, I think this is out where, Brooklyn or something, in New York, over?
Yes, we're the Kings County Radio Club, King County, Brooklyn. We have our repeater in downtown Brooklyn. So, you know, it depends, you know, those radio wave propagations are mysterious things, and sometimes they travel a bit farther. So I'm glad you were able to pick up our signal. Like I said, I'm here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 p.m. Our club, the Kings County Radio Club, has an InfoNet every Tuesday night at 9 p.m., so you might want to listen up for that as well. You're always welcome.
Yes, sir. Everybody have a good evening. This is N2JLF. I'll be monitoring a little bit more. 73 to
you. Okay, very good. Thanks for popping in, and have a good day. 73. Anyone else with any questions or comments before we call it a night here?
N2VA with a follow-up.
Yes, sure, Max.
So, just from our conversation, I'm looking for a toroid, just on Amazon, just to see if I can get one to, you know, put on at the end of the wires we talked about. And, of course, it's a rabbit hole. So right now I'm looking at two types, FT240-31 core and FT240-43 core. Which ones do you usually get? 43 cores, I see type 2 cores, it's just, what the heck does this all mean?
I am a big fan of Mix 31. I get most of my stuff as Mix 31. The other one tends to be a little bit better for higher frequencies, but you know, if you factor in the way the permeability gives you impedance, it tends to iron out even at 10 meters. So I find that type 31 is a good jack of all trades for myself. But, you know, there will be people who tell you that the 43 is the best.
Perfect. That answers my question. So one, I can't really go wrong with either, but 31 in your experience is better. So I just got to make sure one that's big enough for me to play with. That's cool. This is all brand new stuff for me. All right, appreciate it. That's all for now. We'll see.
I hope it works out for you. Like I said, I was a big proponent of clamp-ons. They're a little bit easier than running a coil through a toroid, but you know, you can't go wrong with you know, squaring the number of loops, improving the amount of RF choke capability. So, hope things work out for you. These things are not binaries, of course. You can apply an RF choke, and it'll decrease the amplitude, but it will never decrease it to zero. So you just want to decrease it to a manageable level where it won't interfere with any of your electrical equipment, because we don't live in a perfect world where, you know, we can zero out things. So I wish you good luck, Max. Anyone with any other questions or comments for tonight before we call it a night?
Hello, KD2MYS. I have a general question, not a specific question. I know that Kings County is getting ready for field day, and I wanted to know, in terms of technical advice, if you have any advice, you know, things that we need to buy for our new field day. I know it's not a specific question for me personally, but in general, because you usually, you know, you are on the other side listening to what is happening for field day, I wanted to know if you have any, you know, advice, any technical advice for our field day coming up. Back to you.
Okay, that's a good question. Nothing specific. I mean, N2GOT. Howard is an old timer for these field days. He's been going to them for decades, and he pretty much knows all the tricks. You know, there are different tricks for different types of field day environments. Some field days are full of a lot of radios operating at the same time. And I think at one point we did purchase a bandpass filter. So if you're going to be operating more than one radio with antennas very close to each other, it's always good to have a bandpass filter to separate the bands so that you don't get feedback into your receiver from very nearby stations. That's kind of the only thing that I can think of. You have to understand the social aspects of field day. Some operators like privacy. Some operators like to be showmen. So if you have more than one station, and the weather is nice, you might want to put one on the outside or close to the outside so that visitors can see it in him in operation. And the guy who wants to just do it by himself quietly in the back, I set up a place for him. So those are my only particular words of wisdom.
Thank you, Roy. I think that this time around, we might probably have one radio outside. So we'll see. Thank you. Back to you.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Berlat. I wish you luck. The only real way that the field days go sideways is when the weather goes bad. Unfortunately, our field day location is not designed well for rainy weather. Everything turns to mud and falls apart. And there's been more than a few field days that had to be cut short because of flooding conditions and tents falling over and such. So, if you could talk to Howie, KD2MSU, and have him make sure that the weather is good that weekend, that's probably the most important thing.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And everyone else is thank you all for participating tonight. Again, I'll give one more opportunity. If there's anyone with any questions or comments before I fold this up for tonight, then hit that push to talk and say your piece. Very well. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York, and we meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be May 3rd, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general club meeting can email me with some form of identification for a required link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 to 10 o'clock, depending upon the number of points that need to be covered. We have weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m., and we also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband, or if not there, very near to there. We offer an audio stream of our KC2RC repeater on the internet, as well as our 10-meter net. You just type into your browser stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the hosts of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of these technical nets, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services were generously donated by a local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank for their generosity. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. So it's time to roll this all up and shut it all down, but we'll be back to do it all over again April 26th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, especially my co-host, Bob, KD2NVB. Without you guys, I'd be talking to myself. So this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Take it easy, be well, and we'll talk down the line. This is AC2GS clear.
This is Alpha Charlie 2, Zulu Victor, William, checking in late for the TechNet. Sorry about that if you guys are already done for the night. But I thought I'd just check in and say hi. I thought I saw some people online, and I was on the phone. So if anybody's out there.
Seem to work anymore. Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, William. We just kind of shut it down for the night. I'm sorry you missed it.
That's fine. I don't mind. I just wanted to check in and say hi. I was thinking about you, but I got caught in a long phone call, and I just couldn't get away. So anyway, thanks for hosting the TechNet tonight, Roy, and I'm always with you.
Thank you very much. I do appreciate your participation and your involvement in all these things. And you're one of the pillars of the club, and I do appreciate your efforts.
Talk to you on Sunday, although things get so difficult sometimes. But I do try and think of you, and I think the radio works, so hopefully we'll check in Sunday.
Okay, I hope you have the opportunity. This particular Sunday is the third Sunday of the month. I get the day off, or at least the morning off. I never get the night off. So, Howard, KD2MSU, will be net control operator this Sunday morning.
What do you have to say about the weather?
Yes, I'm sure he'll have a lot to say about the weather.
You know, I found out something very strange about this physical number called 137. Have you ever heard of that?
Yes, that's the fine structure constant.
If you multiply that times 73, you get 10,001.
Okay, but I don't think that actually has anything to do with anything. It's just coincidence. You know, 137 is important as the fine structure constant. It has to do with the interaction of electrical charge and electromagnetic waves and such. So it's a kind of a fundamental constant that there is no good theory explaining why it has that value. It's an experimental value. How you manipulate that number is almost kind of reminiscent to something called geometria, where everyone kind of, especially with the Bible, they'll translate the letters into numbers, and then they'll add up the numbers, and then they'll translate it back into letters in another language, and they'll say, aha, it predicted JFK's assassination.
Anyway, I thought it was interesting because as ham radio people, we use 73 all the time, which is a prime number. And then if you multiply 73 times this constant, you get 10,001. And then if you multiply that by 1111, you get 11,111,111. You know, it's like more than 711.
Okay, well, but you got to understand, most of that is coincidence, and the other part is just random decisions of people using different things to code different things. I mean, occasionally, I've gotten people who send me 88s, which is not a prime number, which translates as love and kisses. Say again, I only heard the second half of that transmission.
Yeah, I've seen those 88s, and I've read that whole list, and it's too bad we're not running a railroad, because there was all those interesting things people used to do with all those extra numbers all the time.
Well, you know, I mean, that was the origin of a lot of that. Not the Q codes. The Q codes were kind of amateur radio and, you know, picking out codes that were easy for Morse code people to hear the difference of. I mean, it's terrible for phone. You know, when people say QRM and QRN, you know, it sounds the same thing to me. So that's why I usually say QR Mary or QR Nancy or something. But most of those were telegraphy abbreviations. And I used to remember a very, very weird abbreviation that basically was the instruction to let the horse loose and send it to the next station. I haven't been able to find that one since then, but, you know, it gives you an idea of what the hell was going on in those train stations and telegraph stations attached to them.
They used the letter Q so that they could have a strange letter that came in to alert the operator that there was a different code coming in, not just a regular quick or some other word like that.
Yeah, that was the idea. And it's fine for CW and Morse code. I try not to use it a lot. I think I used it tonight with QTH. So occasionally I tip the hat to those who came before us. But Q codes really are designed to be used in CW, in Morse code, and certainly not on FM. I mean, the whole point of frequency modulation is that there shouldn't be that much background noise, so readability is not an issue, so you don't have to code things so that the people can figure out what the hell you're trying to say. So people who kind of use abbreviations for repeaters and others on the bands that use frequency modulation are either they're paying homage to those who came before on CW, or they think it's real cool to use those phrases.
Saves time, and it's an in-club kind of thing, because if you don't know what that means, obviously you're not in the club.
Well, you know, sometimes jargon can be very alluring. It makes one feel a little bit more important that you know the secret words for things. I prefer not to be obscure, because there's loads of obscure Q codes that almost no one remembers anymore because no one really used them. Yeah, you got to kind of go to Wikipedia and look them up. So there's a lot of ways to kind of show off to each other that, you know, you know Q codes that the other guy doesn't know. But I don't think that's the whole point of the exercise. The exercise is to be able to communicate with other people, and you have to have a mutually agreed upon common vocabulary. So I like to keep things simple. You know, it's usually easier for me to say my location than QTH, but again, and every so often for the heck of it, I throw those codes out.
Prerogative. Anyway, great chatting with you, Roy. I'm glad you like my mathematical treatise here, but I thought it was really wild that I found out about that constant, and then there was this thing about 73, and it means good night. So, 73s.
William, I mean, if you notice, very often any email that I send, any ham, ends with VY73. So VY73, William, we'll talk to you down the line. This is AC2GS again, and I shall be clear.
AC2CV clear.